TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports.
How you doing?
All the time. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take it with triple chops. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live on TSN1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is, and Michael Remus will be popping in and out throughout the entire program. An action-packed 3 hours in store for you. Coming up in about 15 minutes' time from the Winnipeg Free Press, Randy Turner is going to join us. In the second hour, we are going to focus on football. Dan Widerer of the Minneapolis Star Tribune is going to join us ahead of the big Vikings 49ers matchup tomorrow in the NFL. In the final hour, Richard Griffin of the Toronto Star is going to join us, and Jonah Carey of Grantland.com is going to join us. We're going to talk baseball in that final hour, break down both pennant races.
What we should do, Drew, before we start, we should talk about before you even give us the follow on Twitter and stuff, we should talk about the NHL negotiations.
We're done. Those have been some good discussions. Good negotiations they've had this week. It was that was a long segment. Into the CBA a little bit coming up this hour. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And the website with your latest news and information about your Winnipeg Jets and everything CBA related is www.illegalcurve.com. Richie, Ezzy, good afternoon. How are you, gentlemen?
Good afternoon. I'm loving the new format. I mean,
well, I'll tell you what. I'd be happy to get rid of this new format if they would settle the strike negotiation, get back to playing hockey. We'd be glad to go back to being a regular 3-hour hockey show. But this week they decided to not negotiate and spend time instead in front of the Alberta Labor Relations Board.
Yeah, that and going around on all the media networks and doing their interviews and the propaganda. That was a good use of time.
Yeah, these guys are really they obviously really want to get back down to business here.
We said it many times, but it's a joke that they're not. You know, there's games being lost. There's people's salaries not being paid. And I'm talking about the employees and the workers, not the millionaires and the billionaires here. People who are relying on this money to pay their bills.
Right.
And the NHL, NHLPA, are sitting at home and having a coffee. And when they feel like they need to get into a room, they'll get into a room. But why they're not there right now, when people do rely on that income, clearly shows you how arrogant both sides are. Both sides.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk more of the CBA sort of coming up in about half an hour time. The 12:30 to 1 o'clock will be more CBA related, get into some of the big issues, the hockey related revenue. Elliot Friedman with a terrific article this week on the CBC website that Remus will tweet out on our Twitter feed at Illegal Curve. Let's start with last week, Saturday afternoon last week. Sometimes, you know, you're on air and mea culpa, because I didn't think this was going to get done. But the Winnipeg Jets late last Saturday night signed Evander Kane to the contract, 6 years, $31.5 million. Let me ask you both gentlemen, when we were on air Saturday afternoon and we heard the audio of the interview he conducted with Ed Tate, and we had Ed Tate himself on the air, are you guys surprised that this deal got done when it got done?
Yes, and in fact, we were celebrating Dave Minuk's birthday.
Speak for yourself, I was not celebrating that.
Well, I was celebrating for myself, Dave, and you then. And we were celebrating, you know, his birthday, and we started to see on Twitter that, you know, there were rumors that the Kane contract was about to be announced. So, of course, it came as a surprise. How could it not, when we were less than a couple of hours, an hour away from, you know, the CBA, the old CBA expiring? So, of course, it came as a surprise. And we didn't hear anything of any new developments, or there were no hints of the contract coming. And it turned out that he signed for 6 years and a little bit more money than maybe we thought he was going to sign for. But, of course, it was a surprise. And it's good that the Jets got Kane under contract, but you know they left it literally to the last minute.
I mean, am I surprised that they signed him to the contract? Yes, because just based on the discussions, in Bob McKenzie's report in the morning, it didn't appear that they were going to, and people were back and forth on whether it was even getting done when it was getting done. But I don't think it really shows you anything other than the fact that Evander Kane's agent wanted to you know, make sure he gets a 6-year deal just in case it goes down, the limit goes down to 5 years after this next CBA. Evander Kane wanted to cash in. I don't know if this means that he's going to be in the Jets jersey for the long haul. He had some casual comments about the city of Winnipeg in that conference call, but I mean,
yeah, he said all the right things.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably, seemed like it was somewhat.
Well, you know, you can't. I'm not going to criticize him for what he said. He said
I'm
all
not
the
criticizing
right
for what he said. We're saying reading into it. I mean, right. Do I think it's as per our discussion last week? Do I think it's any more? Do I think it's going to happen that he's going to be here next year? Maybe. Do I think he wants probably out? Probably. Do I think signing the contract means that he wants to be here for 6 years? Absolutely not. I think he wants money. The Jets want to lock him up, and to lock him up makes him more marketable because people who are trading for him know what he's getting, and he's on a 6-year deal if they trade him. If they don't, they know what they're going to get. They're going to get a great score, a guy who's only going to get better. If they do deal him, there's certainty in terms of his cost, and you know when you're trading for somebody else, you know what you're getting back. You can budget it in a far easier manner.
You're not trading for a rental.
You're not trading for a rental, exactly. Yeah. And you're not trading for a guy who will hold out every year or go to arbitration.
That's right. And he could very well be end up being happy in Winnipeg and be here for the 6 years. And we don't know.
But the truth
is, he had a bird in the hand, and that bird in the hand expired last Saturday at 10:59 p.m. Central Time.
The boys, the reality is going into the lockout, and we have no idea how long this lockout's going to be. The fact that now more and more people are starting to say that it's a year is not only depressing, but it's a sign that, you know, these negotiations are really going at a snail's pace and we're far away from a resolution. But going into the lockout, coming out of the lockout, if Evander Kane's not locked up, it's a lot harder to trade him at the beginning of the season and at any point in the season. And the fact that he's under contract for 6 years is obviously good as far as his trade value goes. And we have to, clarify, this as... and I wrote about this on illegalcurve.com about, quick analysis of the signing. It's good that Evander Kane signed for obvious reasons. He's our best player. We get him locked up long term. But the fact is they left it to the last minute, and there are still doubts in a lot of people's minds, myself included, that he doesn't necessarily want to stay here long term. And you have to read between the lines. You can't always just listen to what these guys say because... He in his case, he doesn't say a lot. And Evander Kane would command a lot on the trade market. But there are still questions. Even though he signed, no one saw it coming. And you have to wonder if he was signing really because he wanted to stay here because all the indications were that he wasn't going to sign. So,
well, like you're saying, he signed because it made more financial sense to sign, knowing the circumstances you were signing on last Saturday as opposed to waiting for when the CBA gets dealt with and at that point in time. Let's talk about I don't want to speculate anymore about his intentions or anything else because all of that is a speculation. Let's talk about the details of the contract. It was a 6-year deal, $31.5 million. Richie, when you wrote the original article back, I believe in January, about Evander Kane's value, this is a little bit more than you thought he would get as an RFA. How much do you think that this increase in payment is just due to the circumstances around the NHL changing and all the other guys who are similar RFAs, signed for probably more money than everything else inflated his value?
I capped him my analysis of 4 years, so it's a little harder to compare them because what you're doing is you're using the two UFA years. So I thought he's worth, based on the numbers, before all these crazy contracts were handed out in the offseason, which also proves to you it's probably better to sign early rather than later.
Right.
Because they were obviously affected by Jeff Skinner and the contracts that were handed out. I had him at $16.3 million for 4 years, so just over $4 million a year for a cap hit. If you were to use those numbers and you were to say, hey, he hits the open market, which we talked about, basically, why would you sign more than 4 years? Well, the reason he signed more than 4 years here, at least to me, is he's worth about just over 16 to me. And then if you're going to say
just over $16 million.
Exactly. So the next 2 years, if you think that's what he's worth, you're basically giving him $8 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit less. Just about. So in that sense, you're essentially saying, well, he's not going to make much more than that in the UFA. So if you're Evander Kane, you're doing pretty well. It's more than what was reported earlier.
Right.
They held out longer, they got a heck of a lot of money.
That's right. I mean, the initial offer supposedly from the Jets was, 6 years and
29,
$29 million, and he ends up at 6 years, $31.5 million.
They held out longer.
And that extra $2.5 million is probably, I mean, you can't make a direct correlation, but you can probably infer that it's a result of the Taylor Hall deal, the Tyler Seguin deal, the Jeff Skinner deal, all these other deals that you saw signed in and around the NHL. Remus will tweet out on our Twitter page, at Illegal Curve right now, your original article that you wrote back in January where you talk about the comparisons of Evander Kane. You know, you compared him to, you know, John Tavares and other players around there.
Yeah, and Kessel and Couture and Logan Couture and James Neal on shorter term deals.
Right. But you look at James Neal, a guy who still hasn't signed.
Right. You look at John Tavares though, Drew, and then that's one thing. You know, if you sign him earlier, the other contracts have an effect. But if you look at just player for player, John Tavares signs for $5.5 million a year cap hit, and Kane's is 5.25.
That's right.
I mean, is there a $250,000 difference between those two players on an annual basis?
I think John Tavares is probably worth more than that.
You think? So is John Tavares worth more than what he signed for, or is Evander Kane worth less? If you look at it from that perspective, you can make an argument.
The problem with that is you can't look at each of them in a vacuum. You have to look at the surrounding circumstances. And I mean, and that's what we said. You know, Evander Kane signed for, you know, more than the, got the $31.5 million. Mm-hmm. Largely as a result of all the other contracts that were signed similar to that inflated his value, whereas John Tavares signed in a situation where both sides are sort of just picking at a number out of the sky that they deem fair, not knowing what everyone else around them, the comparables, were going to sign for.
Maybe that's true. You know, if you want to hold strong on such negotiations, you'd say, hey, I mean, it's not that close. Every GM in the league is going to take Tavares over Evander Kane.
Right.
But at the same time, if you're looking at it in terms of the UFA years and things like that, do I think it might have been a slight overpay? Yeah, maybe. More so overpay than underpay, but not really if you're taking into account the UFA years and how much the scout would make on the open market. So, you know, it is what it is. And
it's an overpay, but it's not a significant one that should ever become an albatross.
Yeah, and a lot of these, and as we spoke about off-air before, a lot of these guys are overpays, so then the next payments are going to be overpays. And the GMs generally don't use the system to their advantage. I mean, this is the one thing I talk about. I've talked about on the show before, Ezzy, is that Evander Kane has no rights. None. He can't go to arbitration.
He's got no leverage.
No leverage. So he can't go to arbitration. He's got to sign. If he doesn't sign, what does that mean? He doesn't make any money. So you can, in theory, hold. And that's the point of the system, is that the owners have control, and they lose control as the player gets older. And it happens with what happened with Jeff Skinner, what happened with Taylor Hall, what happened with Tyler Seguin. But these owners are basically the problem is, and this is the problem with coming back to the negotiations. They're blowing up the second contract the way they sign them. They're blowing up the second contract.
Right.
And then they're asking for the players to take the brunt of that.
And the second contract was, they thought that was where they were going to be able to maintain costs at a reasonable level when they signed the old CBA in 2004.
Like, when you're in baseball, and we're going to talk about baseball later, but you're in baseball and you're buying out the guy's arbitration years, you're giving him a lot of money, but you look at like an Evan Longoria contract, and you're not really giving him as much money as the top players. But in hockey, when you're buying out his arbitration years, essentially giving them the same cap hit as close to the best players on the UFA market. So it doesn't necessarily make sense that way, but that's a whole systemic problem more than a Winnipeg Jets problem.
That's right, and that may or may not get resolved in this next CBA, and we'll see how that plays out. But, I mean, like you said, they haven't even started negotiating in a while there, so, you know, that one we'll see as we go along. Let's go to break. When we come back, Randy Turner of the Winnipeg Free Press is going to join us. I'm sure you've seen his articles in today's Free Press. He spent a year sort of behind the scenes with the Jets, seeing how everything came to fruition that fateful day, May 31st, almost a little over a year ago. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290 and tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
On the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Let's welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show our good friend from the Winnipeg Free Press, Randy Turner. Randy, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good. How you doing, Randy?
Pretty good, yeah.
That's good.
Getting ready for winter?
Hey, yeah, no doubt about it. There's certainly a chill in the air.
In more ways than one, I guess, when it comes to hockey, right?
Very good. Nice pun. I like that one. Randy, great excerpt of your new book, The First Season in Today's Winnipeg Free Press. You know, there's just a behind-the-scenes look of everything that had to do with the Winnipeg Jets coming back to fruition. In the excerpt of your new book, you explain that the Jets management actually pondered having Bono of U2 make the Return of the Jets announcement at their concert last May. Would you have been in favor of Bono actually doing that?
I don't even know if they would have been in favor of it ultimately, but it's something that Mark Chipman said that he thought about even as I was at that concert. I remember.
So was I, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the thing I remember about it is that, and that's why I wanted to lead off that segment with that, was because you had all these sort of, in that demographic, sort of happy, cheering people. And I could just imagine these people, you know, Norva Riddell, Jim Ledlow, Mark Chipman sitting amongst them, I think was up with 50,000 people, sitting on this, you know, one of the biggest secrets that you can sit on that they had kept quiet for so long, knowing it was just about probably, you know, 95% to come to fruition. But when Mark said that, he said, you know, he said he certainly thought about it, and, you know, they have connections. I don't know if he would have necessarily had, you know, Bono making the official announcement. I was even wondering if Bono got up there and said the NHL is coming back. I don't know how many people would believe him.
Yeah.
So you would need Mark Chipman. You would need somebody from the Jets, you know, to stand by. But like I said, it was more, like from his point, he says it's not like it was fleeting, but it wasn't like it didn't happen. It wasn't like he didn't think about it.
I think to resonate with the younger fans, maybe you'd have to get Justin Bieber to maybe make that announcement. But Randy, how much of a blessing was it that, you know, the True North / Jets brass was really close to buying the Phoenix Coyotes the year before? And how did that help them with, you know, everything that needed to be done when they transitioned from the Manitoba Moose of the AHL to, you know, bringing, you know, NHL hockey back to Winnipeg?
I don't think it was so much help as I don't think they could have done it.
Really?
I think it would have been logistically impossible had you not been. I mean, they had 133 days to actually, from the day the transaction went through to, you know, to opening, to do things that usually take upwards of 18 months or even, you know, in some cases, 2 or 3 years. But the fact that they had got to the point previously where they were literally planning out press conferences, where they literally, you know, had chairs sitting out and all the research done in terms of marketing and pricing and all that stuff for so long. No question that coming within 10 minutes of getting the Coyotes the year before, it was just basically it ended in one place with one team and picked up with another place, you know, a year, pretty much almost exactly a year later.
Randy, the excerpt you had in the Free Press and the book's going to be called, is called The First Season. Talk about getting the uniform and getting the logo in order. Were you surprised at how much time and effort it took to get that all done?
I'm surprised they did it in so little time, if mm-hmm. that's what you mean. Again, it's something that they had considered, I think, since about the first of the year. Like, even the previous year, I don't know if they'd gone so far down the road in terms of who was it? I think it was in early 2011 when they first brought up the idea of, you know, when they got, I guess, to the point in their mind when it was something that they thought was really going to happen, not really going to happen, but very well could happen, mm-hmm. getting ahead of the curve. And they went to Dorian Murphy and asked him, there's their director of marketing and brand management, and asked him to start, you know, pitching around ideas. And he began, it was kind of fascinating to me because he began right at the bottom, like in terms of, you know, what were the most, like, researching it, you know, what were the colors of most jerseys? What were they, how were the names derived, you know, whether it was cultural or geographical or, you know, had to do with even patriotism. You know, it is quite interesting to me anyway. I guess you get into the minutiae of, especially these days. Imagine in the old days, I'm not sure near as much marketing went into it. But even just the development of it, like just the way it came about that when they arrived at the Jets, even in those few days that they had to roll out that logo and then eventually roll out the jerseys, I think the NHL minimum, like by their bylaws, is that you have to do that in 18 months. Well, they compressed that into like, I don't know how many days, like, the, you know, just a couple months. So, but they had the entire hockey marketing staff, Breedbach, working on it in the New York offices, like the entire staff. Mark Chipman talked about going into their offices there and in their marketing division, and just looking around them, and the entire office, we had, you know, all these images and stuff on the board were all related to the Jets. So it's something that you know, it would just really coalesced in a very short period of time, relatively speaking. So when you say, you know, how much time, it might seem like a long time, but it was actually a very, very short time.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Randy Turner of the Winnipeg Free Press. Randy, you know, in your time spent with the team and behind the scenes there, what do you think has been the biggest surprise for management about the jump from the AHL to the NHL?
The biggest surprise for management, I think that would be everybody thought that this would be a groundswell. Everybody had in their own mind what it would be like if the NHL came back. Right?
Right?
Like everybody has their own. Some people aren't even hockey fans. For some people, the meter didn't even move. But I think they would all tell you that they were amazed at the response locally and moving, not only at the time, you know, like when people were dancing in the streets and all that stuff. I think when we talk about the NHL, we think a lot of about the on-ice stuff, right? We think about, you know, Dale Hawerchuk, Timo Salonen, maybe even back to Bobby Hall. We think a lot about the hockey moments, but I think what transpired in the months that preceding that was just the grassroots sort of embrace of the team, you know, where it's just now everywhere, right? I don't know about you guys, and I think this has been the way for a while. You can't go to work, you can't go to the office, you can't go to the grocery store without seeing a Jets logo somewhere.
Right.
You just can't.
Yeah.
Or a license plate. Like after a while, it dawned on me that, you know, just how pervasive this all is. And I think when you talk to even somebody like Mark, when they see that, you know, when you go into the, you know, 7-Eleven and there's the, you know, Jets lighters, or you go into a pet store for heaven's sakes and there's Jets dog leashes and things like that.
I own one of those, so you're speaking. You're preaching to the choir.
Yeah, and Jets dog. What do you call them when the dog
rolls
up and goes
things
to sleep?
Yeah.
But all that stuff. And I think what he said, what he was meaning by that, is not just the, wow, aren't we making a lot of money off merchandise? I think what set in for them, I think more than they expected, is just the accountability and responsibility of that, and that, you know, when you're embraced like that, moving forward, it can be, I don't want to say maybe intimidating is too strong a word, but I think they understand what the connection means with the fans and how they are going to need to foster that and be responsible for that going forward. And I think probably, I don't want to speak for them, but I think if you probably asked them, and I think, I don't know about you guys either, but everybody thought it would be a monumental thing, and now we're living it. But I never even envisioned a day when the old Jets were here, how pervasive that was. Like, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when the Jets were here, and I do not remember seeing Jets paraphernalia and gear everywhere and flags flying and license plates. Mm-hmm. That's a different time. So now when you're with the Jets, when you are the Jets, when you own the Jets, I think that's a constant reminder of the job you have to do, right? You don't want to let these people down.
Randy, the first season is the second book you've written about the Jets. Back in the Bigs was the first book.
Great book.
In writing these two books, what's the most surprising thing that's happened, you know, as far as the process of writing about the Jets?
That's a good question. I don't know if surprising is the right word. I mean, there's two different things. I mean, when I wrote the first book back in the Bigs, I guess I was in a way surprised because now we're talking about, you know, X amount of years later, 40 years later, I think. I was surprised, to be honest with you, about the lack of the thing that I just talked about. I almost had to be reminded because we went through that period of loss and everybody was upset, and there was this kind of a mythical image that developed around the Jets about how important they were and how big they were. And then, but you go back through the, you know, the time they were actually here, and realized that, no, they weren't that pervasive. It was, you know, they didn't sell out. They had, even in their zenith, they had 12,000 people in the stands, you know. I think I've said that to you guys before. I said that it was kind of a reminder that as much as we seem to miss what were we thought, you know, it's something, you know, when you lose something, sometimes it becomes, develops its own, it's almost like history's rewritten in your own brain.
Right.
I think you guys know what I mean. That, it wasn't, as much as everybody says it was heartbreaking and everything, well, if it was so heartbreaking, it might have been heartbreaking for a lot of people, but it still didn't sell out when Timo Solani was scoring 76 goals or whatever. So there's kind of a, those two dots don't connect. So that's kind of what reminded me, you know, that's what I, not surprised me so much, but just was reinforced in the first book. And then this one, which is not, you know, when they call it a book, there's a lot more to it. It's not, it's a different style of the first book. The first book was kind of storytelling about the whole establishment and the Jets and then the loss of the Jets. And this one picks up from where the first one ended. And it's, I don't know if you guys have seen it yet or not. I've only seen it for a bit, but there's a lot of it in there. There's just photos, tons of photos. There's, it goes into them. Not so much, my part was kind of like the behind the scenes of the making of the Jets and, you know, before they kick off, but we've got a page by page summary of every single game that they played with art. We've got highlights of every, you know, occasion, whether it was the opening night or Timo Solani's return. It's kind of like the whole, it's, imagine a media guide sort of on steroids. It's, you know, it's got all the stats. It's not as in depth, say, for the storytelling part, but there's a lot more in it for people to thumb through and kind of go, oh, I remember that game, or I remember this, or I remember that. I think people, when they flip through it, it'd be kind of like a yearbook, you know, from high school sort of thing.
Randy, I picked one up yesterday at McNally Robinson, and just for Jets fans out there, you have to have it for the first season because, like you said, you've got the game summaries in there and every single significant moment, the top five games. It's one of those things that you have to have. You got to put it down on your desk or your table. It's a must-have for Jets fans for sure.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's thumb through. It's only, I think they're selling for $19.99 or something like that. So a lot more affordable for even younger fans that, you know, teenagers who might not say the previous book was some $35, more of a coffee table book. This is more of a kind of a handheld, a lot more utilitarian. You can, you know, I think people enjoy it.
And if you have someone like Drew to lend you the $20 too, it helps.
Exactly. The book is called The First Season. It is written by Randy Turner of the Winnipeg Free Press, available at the Free Press offices of winnipegfreepress.com or any of the Jets team gear stores. Like you said, it costs $19.99, and a dollar from every book sold goes to the Winnipeg Jets True North Foundation. Randy, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Take care,
Randy. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the program. A big thank you to Randy Turner of the Winnipeg Free Press. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. This segment of the show is brought to you by David Carr of Monopoly Realty. Buying and selling a house is one of the most important and stressful life experiences. It is not something to be undertaken by yourself or left in the hands of a rank amateur. David Carr of Monopoly Realty takes the stress out of your real estate experience while you are secure in the knowledge that a true real estate professional is looking after your transaction. That's David Carr of Monopoly Realty, 230-6129. Give David Carr of Monopoly Realty a call, 230-6129, and tell him that Illegal Curve Hockey sent you.
Specifically me.
And me.
And Richie.
If somebody calls me and says, you know, Ezzy sent me, I'm hanging up on that guy.
Yep. Give him a call, though.
Give David a call. David,
you always have problems with this. Give David Carr a call.
It's a bit of a mouthful, you know.
Seashells,
David Carr a call. Yeah, you and your seashells. Anyways,
there's been a lot of talk in the CBA negotiations, because there certainly hasn't been a lot of negotiations. There's been a lot of talk about revenue sharing and how the NHLPA thinks that they should have a say in how the NHL runs its business. Before we get into the revenue sharing, I find the arrogance of the NHLPA trying to dictate to the NHL how to run their business to be a little much. You're an employee. You don't get to say how the business is run. You know, I work at we all work at various jobs. Mm-hmm. We don't get to tell our boss how we think they should run their business.
I think one of the things I was actually thinking about, you don't know how much exactly these teams make, but I was talking about somebody about this week. Some of these players make way more than the owners make off the teams. I know the increase in there's an increase in franchise value and all those things.
Right.
But it's funny to think about the fact that there are players who make far, if these teams are losing money, like in Anaheim, for example, there's a player like Ryan Getzlaff who's making $6 million, whatever it is.
Yeah. And the team
and
is losing
the team's
money.
Losing $6 million.
Yeah.
So the
I know it is a bit of an irony in that sense of the word.
Now, of course, if you are losing $6 million, why are you paying him $6 million? But that's a whole other story.
Also, why are you in that business? But anyways, the revenue sharing is not it's not easy to qualify for NHL revenue sharing. Yes. So I mean the concept that there's an extensive revenue sharing program in place in the amongst NHL owners is a bit of a fallacy.
Yeah.
You know, let's go through the requirements, Richie.
It's Article 49 of the CBA.
Okay. Of the 2004 CBA.
Yeah, which already has expired.
Right.
So what they have here is there's a master list. So they have a preparation of a master list. And it's section 40, article 49.3, subsection A, sets out that there's a master list ranking clubs from 1 to 30. And they're ranked based on their individual club gross preseason and regular season revenues. So the gross revenues rank the teams from 1 to 30. If you happen to be...
The team that makes the most revenue is 1. The team that makes the least revenue is 30.
So you have 1 through 30.
Right.
The next step is, who's ineligible? Who can't get revenue sharing
Straight off?
Exactly.
And certain teams are immediately not eligible based on the population in their market.
And we'll talk about that. So there's three things, and it's or. So it's not, you don't need to have all three of these. You just need to have one of these three.
Right.
And then you're ineligible.
Okay.
So here's number one. If the club is in the top half of a master list.
If you are in the top 15 revenue-generating teams in the NHL.
For that year.
And it's a year-by-year thing. Yeah. So if you're in the top 15 of the revenue-generating teams in the NHL, you are not eligible for revenue sharing.
That's what happened to the Jets last year, right?
That's right. They finished in the top 15. They weren't eligible for revenue sharing.
If the club is
this
in...
number two now.
This is number two. This is the second one that can knock them out. If the club is in DMA or the equivalent BBM market, so television and population market,
right,
with a value of greater than or equal to 2.5 million households.
If your local market has more than 2.5 million people in its vicinity and in its area, you are not eligible. Perfect example, the New York Islanders.
Yes. Their market, they don't make a lot of money, although they have a good TV deal. They don't make a lot of money, but because their market is so big,
being all of New York, they're not eligible for revenue sharing, even if they have... I mean, we went to a game in Long Island this past year. Even if they have 8,000 people in the arena, they're immediately not eligible because they have... Honestly, what the NHL is saying, there's so many people around you, you should be able to draw enough people.
Exactly. They don't have that.
Right.
So the third one is if the club has available team player compensation for the league year that exceeds the targeted team player compensation for such league year. I have to read more about that, because
that seems
like something that is written by a lawyer, only understood by lawyers. Well, Richie's
and I have to read it more, because I don't even understand.
Richie's a lawyer, so what does that say?
It's like, what's the financial derivatives? It's like financial derivatives.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nobody really knows what a derivative is, but they seem to be playing with our money using derivatives.
Even investment bankers don't know what a derivative is.
Exactly. So that's the basis for the revenue sharing. If you fall into any of those first three categories, you're not eligible. So immediately, of the 30 NHL teams, 15 aren't eligible. And then even more so, you cut down that list of the bottom 15 based on some of the other population factors. Really, the New York Islanders are the perfect example of why of a team that's not eligible for revenue sharing that should be eligible.
Right, and obviously we all know that the biggest issue right now in the CBA negotiations, the core economic issue that everyone's heard ad nauseum about, is the hockey-related revenue and the fact that the NHL owners want to take down the percentage of hockey-related revenue that the NHLPA receives on behalf of their players, or the players receive. And another huge issue with this, Richie, is the teams and how much money they're getting, and the problem, because everyone knows that that this is about money, and you know, there, as far as I'm concerned, everybody's lost. Whoever wins this, obviously, you know, the owners and the players, one side's going to win the negotiations. But as far as the sport and, you know, the league, the NHL, we've all lost. Anytime there's any time, this is my own personal opinion, anytime if we end up losing even a half season, you know, the fans have lost. And if the fans have lost, that's what it's all about. You know, then really, who cares if the players get more in negotiations? But as far as the league and the teams in the league, you've got teams that are in serious problems. It's having serious problems. And the Islanders are a perfect example. If they don't get a new arena, they're done. And if they don't change that model and they don't find a way to fix that...
Here's my... Look, revenue sharing is something between owner A and owner B and owner C and owner D. The players. Okay. And, you know, and this is really...
I can cut in quickly and read about that third clause.
Save it.
Okay.
This is what's crystallizing to me, you know, in these negotiations. Generally, I fall on the side of the players. Because, you know, the owners... My theory is the owners sign the players to the ridiculous contracts. Why should the players be punished for it? Lately, though, here's where I'm coming around to thinking. One, what business do you know of that guarantees their employees 57% of all revenues? There's none. There's no business in the world that...
Well, we made this point so many times, Drew, that baseball doesn't guarantee revenues and pays out less than all the other leagues.
Right.
Well, and another point, too. Continue what you were going to say.
And the second point is, the NHLPA is very arrogant in assuming that they should be able to dictate to the NHL how those teams run their business. It should be of no... It should have... Donald Fehr and the players should have no input into whether or not the owners want to have a revenue-sharing system. It's arrogant for Donald Fehr to come to the table to Gary Bettman and say, this is my counter proposal. It really has nothing to do with salary so much. It has to do with how your owners...
He's not an owner. Fehr is not an owner.
The players aren't owners.
Right.
How your owners run the business.
Except if you're Mario Lemieux.
I guess the question is, who brought in revenue sharing in the first place and how did it come to be?
Well, the owners made a mistake in 2004 by pretending it was a partnership with the players. It should never
That's
have been
exactly
a partnership.
Right. Exactly right.
It should have been an owner... owner-employee relationship, nothing more. The players, the employees, should have no real say in things regarding scheduling, in regards to conference alignment, in regards to playoffs. They should have no say whatsoever about that. That would be like me saying to my boss. That'd be like me saying to my boss, you know, I appreciate you telling me what you want me to do, but I think that we should go back to the drawing board and find something that works better for me. You know what my boss would say to me? Get out.
See ya.
You don't have a job here anymore. So it is arrogant from my perspective that the players seem to think that they have this right to dictate to the owners how they should run their business.
The problem was the owners opened that door and they now have to live with it or try and fix it.
So I don't fault the players necessarily. I fault the owners for even creating that possibility to begin with.
And that's exactly. I mean, that's the problem. And what they try and do is they try and pick and choose what they want from the NBA and the NFL and all that, but they don't test it, right? So the test is really the 7 years. A lot of the things that they tried to test didn't work out for them. Now they want to change it all. But the players don't like being that test project, essentially.
That's right. And I mean, the problem is they did
well off of it.
You know what the true problem is? At no point in time should they have ever tied, because, you know, revenues, it's something you can't always project. Nobody knew that revenues were going to skyrocket in these last 8 years the way they have. They should never have tied revenue, the salary cap to revenue.
The NHL is a funny thing, though. The NHL pressures the fans into buying tickets.
Yeah.
It
increases
revenue. Then as soon as you don't buy tickets, they threaten to pull the team. Like they do. They have this way of doing it. You know, if you don't buy this many tickets, you might have to leave. Yeah, in Phoenix, they don't leave. So, I mean, the NHL is so hypocritical, though.
The reality is
no
that
argument.
The people that are paying the $150 and pro sports, the NHL, it's all become so expensive. And you're never going to see an owner say, you know what? we're going to deal with this by lowering ticket prices. They're never going to lower ticket prices.
Of course they're not. And you're never going to have a situation where, at this point in professional sports, where a salary cap is not tied to revenue. So, I mean, unfortunately, that's off the table. It should be on the table, but the owners themselves have made their own bed so that it's not on the table. But the fact that the players do think that they are entitled to 57% of all revenues, when nowhere else in any business ever has the employees been entitled to that share of a percentage, it is somewhat ridiculous that they think that they should, for perpetuity, get this 57%. And the reason why the NHL is so give us the 57% and go share revenue amongst yourselves, but we're not going to take anything.
Well, no,
any
but
responsibility.
That's the position Donald Fehr is taking, and let's be honest, he's really new to being the head of the NHLPA, and that's the position he's taking, and that's what's starting to scare me. And you know, even though I still think there's a chance that they get rid of this lockout in the next month,
Richie,
it's scaring me that this could last longer than we originally thought.
We've got to go to break, obviously, but you know that third clause that was obvious was confusing to me.
Yeah,
it's awfully confusing. It's more confusing that we can't even explain it on the air. But there's a good article online by Tyler Dello that I sent over. Remus is going to post it on Twitter. It'll explain it. Basically, what he even says is from the article that we're quoting right now. That's going to be linked. Is he says so? The point here is that you can fall below the top 15 in revenue and still be ineligible for revenue sharing dollars if you have a certain amount of revenue. Problem is we don't have enough financial information to actually know which teams qualify or don't qualify.
Because they're private businesses.
It is as confusing as the wording says because there's further definitions. You know, in all these CBAs, they have references to words that have been defined earlier.
Sections and subsections, and you got to revert back and everything else. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment is brought to you by Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, home of Canada's only coal-fired pizza oven. Taste the difference at Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, 1580 Taylor Avenue, pizza baked, well done. Great pizza, of course. You guys know it all too well.
Obviously.
Big sponsors. Carbone has been a sponsor of ours for a while now. We're very happy and proud to say that we have a good working relationship with them.
Pizza and keeps getting better, by the way.
It's true. It's true.
The more and more you eat it, the more and more you like it. And
you just don't get insight like that on every show.
That was deep. It was well thought out.
Yeah.
Well articulated.
I'm really glad
you just said pizza gets better.
No, but it literally has been getting better.
They have new flavors and things and new recipes that make it better.
Mastering it.
That was insightful.
Well, it was more insightful than your jargon.
As opposed to our show, which gets worse.
I beg to differ.
Our show starts at a peak and just diminishing returns.
Our show depreciates.
I digress.
Law of diminishing returns.
I digress.
One of the other central issues, of course, of the CBA lockout, we're very happy to report that there were no negotiations this week. But, you know, Eric Bélanger and Devin Dubnyk really spoke articulately about the Alberta Labor Relations Board hearing yesterday.
Oh, good.
You know, it's embarrassing that they...
It's embarrassing. It's just a waste. They're trying to waste each other's time.
Well, exactly. That's insulting to the fans. But it is also embarrassing to hear some of these players try and articulate their case. Because, I mean, they obviously use the same cliche lines. So that's not a surprise.
Because it's the kids that get the talking points.
And they just keep, you know, repeating them over and over again. Right. But the best is when they answer questions that have nothing to do with the talking points, and they just use the talking points again.
Well, it's unfortunate.
That always happens.
It's
exactly.
Unfortunate because they're frustrated. And, you know, there's anytime any of these guys goes anywhere, there's a camera in their face and they're asking these guys questions.
They should be like, look, the NHL just fined the Detroit Red Wings $250,000 today for Jim Devolano speaking on the record about the lockout.
The problem is,
and Jim Devolano is a hell of a lot more intelligent and articulate than a lot of these players who are speaking publicly. And that's
some of the players are articulate, but you don't need them speaking on issues that they don't know enough about.
Also, exactly.
This is a complicated matter. This is basically jurisdiction shopping.
Right.
And what they're trying to do in Alberta is pin the Oilers in Calgary to the Alberta Labor Relations law.
The Oilers and the Flames.
The NHL's taking a stand that the law that they're going to be working under is the federal law of the United States.
Same thing that they did in Quebec last week.
In Quebec, they said they wouldn't give an injunction. They wouldn't stop the lockout, but they look at it further, and it'll get washed away.
And it's not stopping the lockout. all this would do, it would mean that the Flames and the Oilers and the Habs would...
Nordiques.
inevitably. Would have access to the team facilities and everything else. I don't believe they would get paid, but I don't know for sure about that. I'd have to double check. But
by the time this is resolved, the lockout will be over anyway. So
I'm not so sure about that anymore. Anyways, hockey-related revenue. You know, it's the number we've heard HRR. We've heard it over and over again, and you know it's the pie that the players and owners split. There's a great article.
Not evenly, though.
Well, not evenly, of course.
It's like when you're eating Pio Desi.
Yeah, as he takes two-thirds of it. Yeah.
Drew gets 57%.
Yeah. Great article by Elliot Friedman.
Did you just take a bite of pie?
discussing the hockey-related revenue and what the owners are able to deduct from the hockey-related revenue that the players are upset about.
And, you know...
There's certain aspects of...
The basic contention is the... After, and there's a good article in the Globe, too, about the numbers and about ownership numbers and auditing and such, but the basic idea of Elliott's article is that at the end of the day, the NHL players don't think they're getting 57% of the revenues. They think they're getting 51%.
Right.
So they think a drop is going to be like, below 50%.
The owners, the teams are allowed to deduct certain expenses. You know, they're allowed
And let me quickly get in there, Drew. There's a lot of... they talk about the luxury boxes. They can deduct a certain amount of the luxury boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a very fine... There's not fine. It's a very big gray... It's a very significant gray area here because, you know, Elliot gets into whether these people, these corporations really, who are buying the boxes are buying them for the music events, the other events that take place in the arenas, or the hockey as the primary reason. You'll never know that. You can question on it, but on a year-to-year basis, I mean, if you're a corporation and you're trying to fill client need and you're going to use this to try and appeal to your clients, maybe you have half your clients love music, maybe half of them like hockey. Obviously, there can be an overlap there, but you have to appeal to both. And so to get into that interpretation, and that's something that I think they've said, Elliot says that the owners are probably okay with leaving it as it is. The players maybe less so.
The players want certain...
I don't think this is going to be as big of an issue as maybe people may point it. Paint it out to be.
The players do not want the owners to be able to deduct what they currently have been able to deduct. Things like jet fuel, the owners are able to deduct from.
Yeah, why not?
Well, business expenses.
Expense.
The masseuses that the teams employ.
It's expense.
The owners are able to deduct that from the hockey-related revenue. And like you said, concessions. You know, all the concessions where they generate revenue, they also have to pay employees to run those concession stands. The owners are able to deduct, I think it's about 54% of their costs of concessions from the hockey-related revenue. The players want to put an end to the owners being able to make these constant deductions. They want, you know, they want 54%, pardon me, 57% of all the revenue, and they don't want the owners to be able to deduct anything from it.
I have a question for you, Drew. When did the NHL become introduction to financial accounting?
It's true, isn't it?
I mean, like, these guys, on average, make $2.5 million a year.
The players.
And the players. And now the NHL and the NHLPA are obviously part of, you know, splitting up the pie is defining what the pie is. And obviously, I understand.
They've defined the pie, but now they're trying to subdefine what constitutes the pie.
Right. And the thing is, the reality is the NHL, each team has their own accountant, and they have to report their revenue to the NHL. And the NHL then has their own auditor. And then, you know, comes, I think it was Arthur Levitt last time. I'm not sure if he's doing the report again this time around. And then the NHLPA is obviously going to hire their own auditor or probably team of auditors. I imagine there's 20 auditors that go over everything. And I imagine that's the case. But these are things that should be done in a boardroom, and we shouldn't be having to read about this in the media. I mean, the fact is the NHL owners are going to deduct whatever the accounting they use. And I mean, Richie mentioned the article in the Globe and Mail, I believe it was by David Ebner, and they were talking about transfer payments, how sometimes you use sponsorship or a TV deal and you don't include part of it on your... I mean, the fact is, if the NHLPA doesn't like how they report it, then they can do their own report, and then they have to come to some type of agreement. But the fact that, you know, this has become what it's really all about. At the end of the day, the owner, the players' average salaries are still going to be in the $2.2, $2.3 million range. I mean, this isn't really going to significantly alter the landscape of the salary cap. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars here, and these guys are still going to get paid. So this shouldn't be the focus as far as I'm concerned.
There's a reason we're talking about football next. Enough's enough here.
Well, this is it. I mean, they haven't met.
It's what Gary Bettman and Donald Fair have people talking about.
It is. You're right, Richie.
It's hockey-related revenue. Yeah. It's hockey-related revenue, and who's writing off the Fry machine? Seriously, exactly, who's writing off the Fry machine? And, and who qualifies for revenue sharing based on the 25% of the team-related revenue and blah, blah, blah.
Like, are we nickel and diming an industry, a $3.1 billion industry? Yeah. Is that what it's come to
instead
here?
Instead of talking about, you know, who's playing with who and where Oleokun's lining up and throwing away the fans that they gain from the L.A., from L.A. being winning the Cup this year, Chicago winning it recently, Detroit winning it recently, Pittsburgh and Crosby winning it recently, Philly being in the finals. Just as they did, these sides did, in 94 when the Rangers had won the Cup, L.A. had went to the Cup the year before.
They ruined all the momentum.
They ruined all the momentum.
That's
and,
right.
And Chicago had gone to the Cup a couple years before that. Pittsburgh had won the Cup with Lemieux twice in a row, and they throw it all away because at the end of the day, they care about the bottom line, and they don't care at all about the fans because they know they'll come back like they always do.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. We're pleased to be joined on the line now by Dan Wiederer. He's the Vikings beat writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Dan, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Dan, I mean, big game tomorrow. Vikings, the Vikings are home to the Niners. The Vikes 1-1 after two games. Had a real good opportunity last week in Indy to get to 2-0. Adam Vinatieri's foot prevented that from happening. When the Niners come to town, that means Randy Moss is back in Minnesota. You know, how do you rate? How would you rate write and discuss Randy Moss's overall legacy as a Minnesota Viking?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see the reception tomorrow afternoon at the Metrodome. Obviously, this is a building in which for so many years he was such a superstar, and then his very short-lived 2010 return went so sour so fast during a season that was filled with so much melodrama. I think most people sort of embrace and remember Randy for the days that he was as productive as he was for the early parts of his career and have sort of pushed that 2010 disaster out of memory. But you know, obviously, this is a guy who put up Hall of Fame stats in the early parts of his career here and then went on and obviously had some success in New England after a not-so-good stop in Oakland. But it'll be interesting to see how the fans here react when he gets on the field for the first time.
Dan, you recently wrote about the tight end position in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Can you elaborate on your article and then talk about how that relates to the Vikings' up-and-coming tight end, Kyle Rudolph?
Yeah, it was actually Chip Scoggins, one of our writers at the Star Tribune, wrote the piece on just the expanding roles of tight ends in the league, and this is something we've been seeing, you know, for the last, you know, 5 years or so with just this evolution of guys who come into the league and can do so many different things to create mismatches, whether it's an Antonio Gates, Rob Gronkowski in New England, obviously the guy we'll see tomorrow, Vernon Davis with the 49ers. Mm-hmm. These are all guys that can do so many different things as pass catchers that put a stress on the defense, and I think the Vikings believe they have one of these guys in Kyle Rudolph. Obviously, a guy a little bit raw as a blocker, but in terms of a pass-catching tight end, huge hands, soft hands, he's got a great catching radius, and he's really developed an early rapport with Christian Potter. They both came into the league together a year ago and seem to be developing quite a chemistry that the Vikings hope can last for years to come.
The backfield, obviously, is dominated by Adrian Peterson, and I mean, his comeback has been something nothing short of amazing, really. How surprised are you at the speedy recovery, and not only that, but his performance thus far?
Well, I'll tell you what I was most surprised by. You know, there was so much question on if he would play in week one, and if he did play, how many carries would he get? Mm-hmm. Next thing we know, Adrian Peterson gets 17 carries, and he almost had himself a 100-yard day.
Yeah.
A couple more blocks, and he would have had it. What's going to be interesting to monitor going forward, as impressive as Adrian's recuperation has been to this point, and it has been really remarkable to watch, is how he can sort of withstand fatigue here, and it's going to be interesting as we get into mid-October and early November, just to see how that knee's holding up, how Adrian's holding up. That's going to be the true test on the success of this recovery, on whether he can be the old Adrian that we're used to seeing and sort of be that guy that can, you know, carry that workload week in and week out without much tire.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Dan Weider of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. We're talking about tomorrow's Vikings 49ers game, where the Vikes will try and handle the 49ers. They really look like the best team in the NFL so far this year. You know, obviously in the NFL, it really begins and ends with the quarterback position. The Vikings drafted Christian Ponder in the first round last year. Starting his second year now, he's looked considerably better this year as compared to last. You know, from your evaluation, what's been the biggest difference in his game so far?
Well, there's no question that Christian Ponder's play through the first 2 weeks has been incredibly encouraging. He's doing exactly what they're asking of him. It's making smart reads, making throws that are there. His completion percentage up over 75% and leads the NFL right now. And he's not making a lot of mistakes, and that's a big key right now for this team is to make sure that at the quarterback position you're getting that consistency in a guy that isn't going to put you in harm's way. And I think even more encouraging than that has just been the drives he's had at the end of the game the last couple of weeks. I think five scoring drives in the fourth quarter the first 2 weeks, and that's something that you can really build off of if you're an offense, knowing that you're never out of a game and that your quarterback's going to rally you. It's going to be interesting to see as the defenses get tougher. He's going to see a pretty good defense Sunday afternoon with the 49ers. We'll get a much better gauge sort of where Ponder's development is.
You know, when Ponder was drafted by the Vikings, he was often compared to a former Vikings quarterback in Brad Johnson. Would you say that his ceiling has increased considerably in his second year?
Well, I don't know that we can say that just yet, but I think what they love about him is that he's a guy with great intelligence. Now, the one thing that I've worried about with Christian Ponder is that he can sort of, get into slumps and struggle to snap out of them, and confidence was an issue definitely down the stretch of a year ago. So it's going to be interesting to see when he hits that first road bump. He hasn't really hit a major road bump yet in 2012. When he does, can he snap back really quickly? Can he avoid sort of that 2 and 3 week stretches where he's out of his rhythm? That's when we'll really know what the ceiling of this kid is. But right now, I think they've loved having a chance to work with him through a full offseason. Obviously, he didn't get that before his rookie year because of the lockout. And they've really seen him take greater ownership and command of the offense. And that's going to be what they're going to look for going forward. And so far, so good through 2 weeks of 2012.
Dan, we wanted to ask you about Matt Khalil. How would you rate his play thus far this season?
Yeah, so far pretty solid. He's had some mistakes, none bigger a week ago than the absolutely foolish personal foul penalty he picked up in the third quarter. That was a quarter for the Vikings that really allowed the game to slip away. They had a flurry of penalties in that quarter, and Khalil was one of the guys who made the costly mistake, a late hit after the play. You got to avoid those types of plays if you're going to be a successful organization right now. But so far, I mean, Khalil's been everything has advertised. A great pass blocker, pretty good in runs. He just really got to keep developing. But I think they were so sold on him going into the draft, used that number 4 pick on him, and to date, it's easy to see why.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Dan Weider of the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Dan, we look at specifically this game. The Niners have given up one 100-yard rushing game in the past 39 contests, which is completely insane. The Vikes obviously are very reliant on the run. How do they beat the Niners this week?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be, as we talked about earlier with Adrian Peterson, we will see just how close to full strength he really is when he goes up against a defense that's as strong as this one. You know, the 3-4 front that they put on, it's a couple fantastic linebackers, mm-hmm. and Patrick Willis and Navarro Bowman and mm-hmm. Justin Smith, who plays that defensive end position in the 3-4, is just an absolute menace up front. There's not going to be a lot of room there, so it's going to be interesting. Phil Musgrave, the offense coordinator for the Vikings, is going to have to get creative. That's one of his strengths, and he's going to have to figure out ways to sort of use Percy Harvin to loosen things up, as we saw a week ago, and then try to establish Peterson. That's where they want their offense to come from, first and foremost, is Peterson and Harvin, and then they'll let Ponder take his chances in select opportunities.
You mentioned Percy Harvin, and it was only a number of months ago where he came out to sort of a bizarre trade demand. Nothing ever came of that. Has the team sort of put that aside and pretended it never happened? We should see a lot of Christian Ponder relying on Percy Harvin in the offense. Is the bond between those two guys legitimately tight?
going back to that June minicamp that you mentioned, it's one of the more bizarre storylines that has existed with this team in 2012. Not only because it sort of came out of nowhere, first season unhappiness and the sudden demand for a trade, but then it disappeared very quickly. And even more surprising than all that is no one has really been able to get to the bottom of the details on what caused that whole rift there for, 72 hours or whatever it was. The organization has moved on. Percy claims he's happy. It's easy to keep him happy when they're feeding him the ball as much as they have. I think 18 receptions through the first 2 weeks. Really a dynamic playmaker and a guy that, when you look forward, he does everything on the football field that you want him to. Can you keep him in full health and full strength, given the way he plays? He's so rugged. He makes so many plays happen, and he doesn't shy away from contact, which is one of the impressive things about Percy Harvin. Obviously, that's been a great security blanket for Ponder early on, knowing that he can just throw those quick hitters. A lot of the passes to Harvin in the first 2 weeks have been behind the line of scrimmage, let Percy do his thing. That helps the completion percentage. It helps in offense. It really, gives you that spark that you need, and we'll see if Percy can keep that up.
We spoke earlier about tight ends. Kyle Rudolph for the Vikings, obviously up and coming. Vernon Davis has looked absolutely dominant the last few games he's played, even going back to last season against the New Orleans Saints. Vikings are going to be without Aaron Henderson in linebacker. How are they going to game plan to stop Vernon Davis, something that really nobody's been very successful at doing?
This is incredibly scary for the Vikings. With Aaron Henderson out with a concussion and Jasper Brinkley, sort of forced to take on Henderson's snaps in the nickel defense, this is a problem area without question, because heading into training camp, the questions with Jasper Brinkley were, he's a pretty good linebacker and run support, can do a lot of things, getting into the hole and making plays against ball carriers, but can he defend dynamic pass catchers? Vernon Davis is one of the best in the league, and I think this is one of those mismatches that if you're Jim Harbaugh and Alex Smith, you look to exploit again and again and again until they show they can stop it, because as you mentioned, it's just an incredible loss to not have Aaron Henderson out there, and then to have Brinkley forced to catch Vernon Davis. They're going to have to do some things creatively, defensively. They're going to have to find ways to get pressure on Alex Smith. But Alex Smith over the last 2 years has been, almost mistake-free. Only 5 interceptions since the start of 2011. None since Thanksgiving night of a year ago. He's just playing incredibly smart football. So it's going to be hard to sort of force him into those mistakes that the Vikings are going to need if they have any chance at an upset.
Last time the 49ers and the Vikings played in the Metrodome, there was a little bit of drama there. Brett Favre to Greg Lewis, really kick-started that fantastic run to the NFC Championship game. They'd be hard-pressed to match that tomorrow, but it should be a good game nonetheless. Dan Weeder of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
You bet, anytime.
Take care, Dan. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Dan Weederer of the Minneapolis Star Tribune for just joining us. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. You can also follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. Gentlemen, what would you do with $72,000?
I wouldn't be doing the show anymore.
I'd buy Remus.
I invested in our parent company, Bell Media.
Well, $72,000 is the average yearly salary for new graduates in the CGA program. Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba, one of the best designations you can get. To find out more information, you can go to their website at cga-manitoba.org or give them a call at 204-477-1256. Again, be sure to tell them that the Illegal Curve Hockey Show sent you. That's the CGA Association of Manitoba, the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. We see more than numbers.
Speaking of finding out more information, I want to find out more information about who left the muffin stumps in the lunchroom here.
Yeah, they took the tops and they left us just the stumps. We walked into the little lunchroom.
Yeah.
There's a box there.
You guys got very excited about the potential for muffins and or donuts.
You open it up, you feel, you give it a little toss, you see what's it, you hear something, you open it up, it's muffins, no tops.
Just the stumps.
Richie thought it was Jay Richardson. I know it wasn't Jay Richardson. I think it was Matty Leibel. I think Matty Leibel ate the muffin tops, left the stumps.
Tried to dump them in the back.
Interesting.
When you take a muffin and you just take the stump, you throw the stump out.
That's exactly right.
You don't put it back in the box for someone to eat.
Nobody wants a stump. If you take the top, Remus is exactly right. You throw out the stump.
It dries out. You have to peel it off that wrapper.
Nobody likes it.
No, it's all about the top.
Getting back to the NFL. The one
Andrew, actually, let's talk about
more about the muffin tops.
the one
issue that has united the entire sports world in the last number of weeks has been the performance of these quote unquote scab refs. Of course, the regular NFL officials are on strike or being locked out. They've not come to an agreement. So you see these scab refs who've been doing the games, and they're almost in an impossible situation. These guys are not cut out to be doing football of this caliber. They're Division III or high school referees. So, I mean, these guys are really, you know, they're the most part-time of part-time officials. Is this a black mark on the NFL and on Roger Goodell for letting this continue on?
I think so. I think it's a safety issue. That Golden Tate hit to the helmet, I guess, 2 weeks ago now.
Yeah.
That went completely unnoticed, and there's a flag on the same play for something else. I think there's a safety issue here, Drew. I think at the same, you know, what you have is you have guys who are owners throwing around millions of dollars. The league throwing around a lot of money, and then they can't give these refs a little bit more cash. I mean, I'm sure they can meet somewhere in the middle. But you can't have, in a league that's a professional league, you can't have all rookie refs running around. And I know there's articles out that say, well, there's been the same amount of penalties as there was last year. It doesn't mean anything because the players are taking more liberties now. They know what they can do, and the coaches. And I know there's been a memo out to the coaches, but the league is blaming the coaches for the league's problem.
Coaches coach for their jobs.
That's exactly
so
right.
If I lose my job exactly because of right. a blown call, yeah,
John Fox is going to be pretty mad if the Denver has a bad season.
Yeah,
because they're given 6 free yards.
That's right. Which is what you saw. What happened in the Denver Atlanta game on Monday night, where the officials counted out. They counted off a penalty incorrectly.
Right.
So, I mean, what you have here is, you know, do you agree that the games are becoming more of a fraud? They're becoming more sham?
I don't know about that, but I just think there is an obligation to get the real referees back here. And, you know, I don't know the particulars. I've read a little bit about it, but the particulars of what exactly the refs are asking for, how much going
to
be?
The sticking point seems to be
the pension.
NFL wants to sort of recalibrate how the officials' pensions are calculated, and the officials don't want to change it. So from what I understand, it sounds like the refs would be glad to sign the same deal that's been in existence for the last number of years. The NFL refuses to do that. They want to change how the entire system of referee compensation is developed.
The fact that the NFL, where franchises are worth, you know, $1 billion each. Yep. You know, they're making billions and that's billions right. of dollars
exactly
in revenue
right.
that they can't pay these refs is ridiculous. Yeah. But to me, as a football fan, it's not going to change my interest in football. I'm still going to, you know, gamble as much and still watch as many games as there are out there. I mean, the games are 4 hours now. It's great. More football. I'm loving this.
Yeah, I agree with Remus there. I don't think it's going to turn anybody off. I know that's been spoken about, but
it's never going to turn everyone off because people dedicate their Sundays to football, and that's
Thursdays,
not going to change. And Thursdays and Mondays and everything else. Right. That's not going to change. I mean, all that's really happening is...
We spoke about yesterday on our way to the concert. I went to the Buddy Guy Johnny Lang concert that Thursday Night Football is the worst thing to ever happen to a girlfriend.
Well, because there's another day that's off the schedule being available.
Richie, for some of us, that is our girlfriend.
Can we talk about... I don't know if I'm that down with these Thursday night games.
I like them already. I'm into them.
It's another day that I have to commit to football. I like the 2 days.
Some of these games, you know...
Drew likes commitment. He's married.
True enough. The Thursday games are fine. Like, I didn't watch the Giants-Carolina game that closely because it was a dog of a game by halftime.
But you didn't think it was going to be. You watched the beginning.
Right. At first, I thought, hey, this is, looks, you know, Carolina.
So Giants look great.
People have the perception of them as an up-and-coming team, but they were embarrassed by the, you know, really the benchmark that you almost have to set your standard to of if you're going to call yourself a contender in the NFL.
It was a big game. We don't want to overreact too much to it, but it was a big game, and Carolina did not look good, especially with the Giants playing without Bradshaw, without Nix.
Yeah.
I mean, injured a cornerback. Carolina, playing at home, you want to bring your best effort. That certainly wasn't it.
Right. I mean, it, you know, sometimes there's a bit of a slow start to the NFL season.
Cam Newton with Superman, which he did, that little routine after the touchdown when they were getting killed.
Yeah.
Maybe they wouldn't have been getting killed.
You're down 42-0 and you show off after getting a sack. It's like, let's chill out on that. You get a running touchdown when the other team's in the most prevent defenses of all time. You know, let's settle down on the excitement in that front. You know, sometimes, at least from my perspective, it takes a couple weeks, maybe all of September, for the NFL to really kick into high gear. Not this year.
No.
I'm intrigued by each and every Sunday of NFL action, really, from the start of the season.
I mean,
you look at this week's games. Look, admittedly, Vikings fan, you know, we go down to Minneapolis, we see a number of Vikings games. I don't think they have a chance against the Niners. The Niners have looked that good. But you have I'll watch the Vikings and the Niners, and then the late game you got Houston and Denver, two very good teams. That's a big AFC clash. Never mind the Sunday nighter and the Monday nighter. But I'll watch any game that's played in Seattle. Those fans in Seattle are terrific.
Green Bay Seattle's a great offensive defensive matchup.
Yeah, and then the Sunday nighter, Baltimore and New England, a rematch of the AFC Championship game last year. These are just marquee game after marquee game after marquee game. Regardless of the fact if I got my fantasy teams, and regardless of the fact if I throw a bet down or two, or play money, fake money, not real money, of course, but there's just so much intrigue week after week after week so far, so early in the season that like you said, Sunday, just book it off. It's football day.
And there's even more reason to make the argument that the NFL and the NFL Referees Association should get this agreement done, because the NFL, it's undeniable in North America. It's the biggest sport.
Yeah.
It's the biggest show. It's the greatest show on earth. You can't argue with that.
That deal won't get done until there's a significant injury. And I think they're getting closer and closer.
But also, the replacement refs are under contract, I think, through week five.
At this point. So there's no incentive to get that done.
True. These guys still prepare for each week and the same. But when you have
the players they can take an extra step. They can hit a guy after the whistle because the official just can't do anything to stop it. You look at that Baltimore.
This is my problem.
It's the integrity of the game.
The NFL talks about concussions. And they're worried about concussions. They're worried about protecting their players. And then they can't give. They fight over with the refs about their pensions.
Yeah.
In an economy that's already getting killed, in a business that makes millions and billions of dollars, and they don't care as much about the safety.
You look at the Baltimore Philly game last week. That was, I mean, less
Washington St. Louis too.
Washington St. Louis. That, yeah. I mean, Cortland Finnegan of the Rams, one of the dirtiest players in the NFL.
Yep.
So when who was it that threw the ball at him that cost him the 15 yards at the end of the game there on the
receiver.
Redskins?
I'm forgetting.
Josh Morgan?
Josh Morgan. Thank you. Josh Morgan.
Former Niner.
Yeah, former Niner. Josh Morgan throws the ball at Cortland Finnegan after he's been getting, face washed and really abused after the whistle by Cortland Finnegan the entire game, because the scab officials, when they call personal fouls, they don't want to pick out one guy and call him. They're doing offsetting personal foul penalties, which are completely insignificant and useless to both sides.
And they're also throwing flags so late, many times based upon the reaction of the players.
My favorite play.
The reaction of the players is amazing. The players are begging for the flags because they know the refs can be intimidated.
Part of it, and intimidated also by the home crowd. I remember in the Atlanta-Denver game, Matt Ryan goes to slide. There's like two guys hit him after. There's no flag when it clearly should have been a flag, and he goes, let's throw the flag,
and
throw
then the flag.
Flag
gets thrown.
And then it gets thrown.
All the PI calls are like that, pass interference calls.
The pass interference call, I think it was the, who did Pittsburgh play? The Pittsburgh Jets game.
Yeah.
Where
you watch that game?
I watched just a bit. I just happened to be flipping by it. I think it was
Mark Sanchez looked good.
Ryan Clark comes in and he hits the Jets receiver with a clean hit.
Who, by the way, they didn't have in Denver the first week, which is a huge loss because he can't play in that thin air.
Because he's got some sort of
sickle cell
disease. He can't play in the high altitude. They didn't have him for that playoff game last year also. Yeah. A really big difference in that game.
Yeah, true.
Ryan Clark comes in, clean hit on a receiver coming over the middle, dislodges the ball, no call. The refs look around after a while. They finally throw a flag for nothing. They blew the call. They said it was a hit to the head. Wasn't anywhere near the guy's head. They don't know. These refs, and I don't blame them. They don't know.
Yeah, exactly. You got to have how many refs? 100 refs, I think there are. You got to have 100 rookies at the same time.
The refs don't know if they're punch or board.
The one thing we haven't even talked about is, not the fact that these refs are reffing high school games during the week, but the fact that, one guy got removed for having the Saints on his Facebook page, and these refs are coming up to guys saying, hey, you're on my fantasy team, I need you to get some yards for me.
Yeah, they did that to LeSean McCoy of the Eagles last week. When the ref is coming up to you and saying that, that blows your mind.
Even as he knows to lock his Facebook page.
Amazing. I can't believe it. It almost seems like this is out of a movie. in this day and age, to think that there's scab referees, it seems like it almost it feels unheard of. But
it's going to you know, you get one of these real rivalry games. You know, Pittsburgh and Baltimore. The two teams hate each other, and they play on the edge when the real refs are there. You're going to play Pittsburgh and Baltimore, and they're going to play each other coming up in a couple weeks. I'm not sure exactly when. These two teams are going to want to – it'll be martial law on the field. They will take every advantage and every cheap shot because they know they can get away with it, because who's going to stop them? These guys don't want to get in the way of these, you know, rampaging – I mean, you know – gladiators, for lack of better word, right now. The way when these guys really get that ferocious and they have that much of a heat on for their opponents, I'm not getting in the way of that for whatever, you know, small amount of money I can take. True. So it just, it's too much. It doesn't make any sense right now for the refs to get in their way. It's going to, and it's not going to end until it becomes a problem and the player gets hurt. And that's really what it boils down to. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to stay on the NFL. We're going to talk about the impact of Steve Sable and NFL Films, one of the really the greatest propaganda arms in the history of professional sports. And I mean that in the most complimentary way possible. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.